Here it goes.
Talk Shoe.
Recorded live.
Well, I'll be. There's actually people on the call today.
Yes.
I thought that since we got the notice out so late, nobody was going to show up. That's kind of neat.
We're here.
Well, that's great. Let's see. Who's here from, first name, from Indiana?
Hello?
Now, somebody's here from Indiana. At least it says on my TalkShoe account that I've got an Indiana person here. You there? Everybody's unmuted.
I'm here, but I'm not an Indiana person.
Okay. Is anybody up in the Midwest?
I guess I am in the Midwest.
Okay.
No.
Is that Aaron?
Yeah, it's Aaron, but I show up as Aaron on the computer. That one who's showing up as Indiana, I bet she's like on the edges or something like that. I know sometimes when I call into places, I mean, I'm in Norman, Oklahoma. It's pretty well central Oklahoma, and it shows me as Western.
You mean Tornado Alley?
Yeah, I don't label it like that, though. But
well,
anyway,
I'm by Seattle, so it's not me.
Oh, weird.
I don't know. I guess we could just mute them and see, you know, when they can't talk, they could figure it out, huh?
Yeah. Hello? Rick?
Yes.
Yeah, hey, this is Jim from Indiana.
Hey, Jim, no wonder it's you.
There you go. That's who's lighting up as Indiana.
Okay. All right, finally, I'm on the cell phone, so trying to find a spot. So.
Okay, good enough. Okay, so we got all kinds of questions today that we want to get to. Let's go back to that place.
Don't forget to start from the bottom up, Rick, because the bottom is the new one, or the bottom is the first one.
Bottom up. Find the questions.
So that's
Yes.
I never thought about how to pronounce that. Doxologia? Doxologia?
Yeah, doxologia. Okay.
Yes.
So, Rick, you said it can take up to a year for us to understand the reason for the affair. Why could this take so long? I'm the hurt spouse and really feel like I'd need to know why the affair really happened before I can move farther in my healing process. I don't know that it necessarily takes a full year. Maybe I should restate that. I was talking with somebody else about this today. The problem with knowing the why, most people want to know the why for an affair in an attempt. They think that somehow knowing the why will stop the pain. And my thing is, the pain is still the pain. I don't think that knowing the answer stops the pain from what actually occurred. So I think that's why I normally say that. You can know the why long before then, but also as you get farther away from ground zero, and the other problem that happens is the pain of the event of the betrayal is so intense that oftentimes it's very difficult to be objective in terms of understanding fully what some of the dynamics were in the marriage even prior to the affair, and that's the other limiting factor where I think you know, as people begin to explore, you know, it's like peeling an onion. They just learn more and more and more as they go along and in understanding ultimately what this thing is or isn't. The person who asked this question, are you online? Okay.
I don't think that they are, Rick. I think I would recognize her name if I saw it.
Well, and hopefully if they are, I'm just going to say I would love to be able to make sure I clarify it. So, but Mary.
She's on the site pretty frequently, though, so she'll see the recording.
Okay. Mary says, hey, Rick, this seems to be the topic of the day. It's been a year since discovery for us. I don't know that we have adequately answered the question, what was the reason for the affair either? We were in a deficit-filled marriage, granted, but all my husband can say is that it was the flattery, or maybe it was the way she looked at me, and I kissed her and started the secrecy in phone calls, etc. We've been in counseling, but have mostly focused on our marriage and crisis survival for me. What is the appropriate course of counseling together or my husband alone? And what does it look like if we want to truly answer the question? Also, it's clear my husband needs a big refresher course in boundaries and grooming behavior. Should he do that counseling on his own or with me involved? I feel as though I direct the course of our counseling, and be frank, I don't think I should be in charge of his education. Are there counselors who are more skilled at this? And if so, how do you find them? Do you offer that service in a course or by phone? Thanks for your help.
And Rick, she's definitely not online. I'm pretty sure she has a TalkShoe account. She's one of our Harboring Hope moderators.
Okay.
That's Mary Jane from the Monday Noon Group.
Okay, so and anybody else can ask a question here to go along. She definitely does not want to be in charge of his education, because ultimately, then, if she's the motivation, then ultimately she's got to be his motivation for the rest of life. I mean, it's got to end up being able to be his own motivation. And it can't be her motivation for him. That being said, I think that I think that, you know, there are probably some really good books to read. I think I may have said this last time, but I really like Shirley Glass's book on Not Just Friends. This fall, we're actually going to be doing a course online for the unfaithful spouse that deals far more with boundaries and how do you address boundary issues, how do you address healing. So there is going to be the possibility to do that in the future. The type of counselor, you need someone who is skilled at working with addictions, I think, if you're going to get somebody who's can kind of begin to help set up a good program for maintaining sobriety and being clean, and especially if you can find somebody who works particularly with sexual addiction or is a certified sexual addiction therapist. And he may go, well, you know, this wasn't a sexual addiction issue, but they will at least understand grooming behaviors and know ultimately how to help give a program. So I would actually look for somebody who specializes in sexual addiction. And in terms of finding out the whys, that's individual work. A lot of that is individual work that your husband would ultimately have to do. In fact, I was just meeting with someone today, and you know, the whole piece of our marriage therapy was, did he want to split off and really get down to some of the core issues? Because it's too difficult in couples work to typically, I think, get down to someone's core issues. And so he would have to be willing to do some individual work. The sexual addiction counseling may actually facilitate his ability to get down to some of those answers. So does anybody need any clarification or any more questions about that? From those of you guys that are online. Well, that's really easy.
Hey Rick, this is Jim. I was listening to your idea of response to her, whoever this person is, being the motivation for her husband or whoever the other person is to be that motivation for the rest of the life. So if it fails, if she can't do that, then is she worse off and just leaving him flounder now?
So in other words,
if she goes into the role of motivator, if she chooses
right.
that education role and fails, is that more devastating to them, her, than if she just kind of stays back where she is now and whatever happens, happens?
Well, I think it's only more devastating, Jim, in the sense that if someone's trying to be the motivator, they're going to take on more of a sense of the failure.
Right. That's where I'm coming from.
Right. They're going to take on more of the sense of the failure, when in reality, if the other person, if they're healthy enough to be able to say, you know what, you need to make up your mind and sink or swim, and I love you dearly. At the same time, you need to decide what you're going to do, and steps back. And then at that point, then the person who's been unfaithful owns it. And if they choose not to, it doesn't feel as personal, I think, to the person who is betrayed.
Right, because there's a lot of personal emotions, it seems, from that side that to me doesn't sometimes make sense, because they don't need to take ownership of it, you know, as your term, take ownership of it, but for some reason they think they have to.
Right. Okay. Back up here. Rick, this is not Janet. This is from the position of the person who had, some say, still having an affair. I will try to be concise with questions to be respectful of your time. Will I, can I ever know and understand the intensity of feelings of the ones I hurt? Total loss of self-value as they share with their own identity, as they share their own identity is subject to who they are with me and our heritage, with family, church, and society. No one person, no matter how good we think we are, is worth another being enslaved to the notion that our only value is through us, or if this is indeed possible. How can I deal with the reality that they can allow themselves to be subjective? How can I live with the guilt that they will always be scared, like witnessing a horrible death? What hope can I have that they can find the respect of themselves to not be weighed down by my stupidity? And there are two pieces here. One piece is that it's not, I think all we can do, is do as good as we can to understand for the other person what the impact of that action is. I mean, that's a really big piece. It's difficult to do. And at some point, you know, we can only go as far as we can go, and it may be something that we learn over time. I think I understand it far better at 25 years than I understood it at year one. So it's a growing understanding. At the same time, the person who's been hurt has to come to the place of also accepting that they can only go so far in understanding, but the very fact that they're trying to understand in some cases has to be almost sufficient, because they'll never truly get it. And so you've got to give up at some point trying to get them to understand better if they've already really worked at trying to understand. Now, if they've never worked at trying to understand, that's a totally different deal. But if they've really worked at trying to understand, and they still just quite haven't hit your standard, at some point you need to go, you know what, they're probably getting it about as good as they can, and that has to be good enough for me. I can't use the fact that they haven't fully comprehended every aspect of this thing as an excuse not to reengage. Let's see. Or if it's indeed possible, how can I deal with the reality that they can allow themselves to be subjective? How can I live with the guilt they will always be scared, like witnessing a horrible death? You know, they won't always be scared like witnessing a horrible death. I know that in the beginning, people live in a great deal of fear of the next bomb going off. But, you know, after about 2 years, after 3 years, after 4 years, really, it's not on the radar screen in the same way. In fact, if someone is always living subjectively to what happened, I call that living to the event, not living from the event. I mean, to me, I want to live this is something that happened in our life, and we live from it. We're actually enriched by it. We've taken lessons from it. God has transformed it, and he's made it something incredible for us. We live from it. Living to it is like always letting that define your life, and it becomes the definitive point, and we are always afraid that it's going to happen again. And it's almost like we're connected to it in a negative sense. So if someone is living from it, I don't think that you would have to be that scared or that guilt about them being scared, because they should move beyond it. And people have to ultimately accept, I think this last sentence is interesting, what hope can I have that they can find the respect of themselves to not be weighed down by my stupid actions or my stupidity. You know, the hope that you have in them is the same as the hope that they have in you. Hopefully they can find hope that you're going to sit there and explore what's happened, let God work through you, that ultimately you can, you know, through surrender or whatever program you work, get to the place where you're not going to ever do this again. And they've got to trust that you're willing to do that work. Vice versa, you also have to be able to trust that they're going to do the necessary work to heal, because you can't do it for them. But if they're a person of integrity, if they want to live, then you can have a great deal of hope that they're going to get over it, and you just need to be able to trust them in the same way that you're asking them to trust you. Number two, will I ever be able to get over, accept, deal with the guilt of the hurt I've caused my family? That is a great question, and for everyone out there who's ever betrayed their mate, been unfaithful in some form or fashion, you better get over the guilt of what you've done, because shame and guilt are the nuclear fuel in the reactor that fuels relapse. And if you don't come to a place of self-acceptance, and if you don't come to a place where you're able to let God transform that loss or work your way through it and find a new way of looking at it, then in some ways you're almost perpetuating the probabilities of it occurring again. And so it's not just a matter of someone else forgiving you. It's also a matter of you being able to accept forgiveness and letting go of the guilt and understanding grace and mercy. But if it's still about performance, eventually you'll fail. Okay, number three, will I be able to get past the guilt and need to accept responsibility for the devastation of another family because of the role I chose to assume and what that led into? More than a friendship, the adopting of another family, the need to assume the support of that family as that marriage. As that marriage was abandoned emotionally and financially. And can I ever hope that anyone, my family or anyone, can understand that I need to help this family have hope to move forward from the death of what they had? Again, like I said before, without understanding grace and being able to accept grace, then I think that one is impossible. But you've got to, I think you accept fully responsibility for the devastation of another family, but you also have to accept and understand where loyalties are, because you can't always do all things. And it would seem to me that your first order of business is really where your commitments are. I guess in my life, I mean, my personal faith would say I have a God that I believe with all my heart takes the worst things that ever happened, ultimately makes it the best, that you never know the end of the story by the beginning, that all kinds of people go through hard things We don't even know what good things are if we don't go through hard things. I mean, people learn. We can only explain things through contrast. And so I believe that, you know, if I do the next right thing, even if I've devastated another family, if I'm being faithful to what I need to be faithful to, that in the long run, God's still going to be able to take care of that family. One of the problems with addiction is that we kind of see ourselves as masters of the universe. I mean, in AA and program, they say that we're massive inferiority complexes clothed in grandiosity and masters of the universe and feel like we've got to control everything. In AA, they also teach the first step is accepting that we can't manage it and we can't control it and we can't make it better. And all we can really do is surrender to God, not fix it. Because, you know, sometimes there are things that messes, I created some messes that were so big, they were ultimately unfixable. Now, if a husband and wife can come to a place, and I don't think the unfaithful mate can push for this too much, but where they can be in agreement on what needs to be done, that's helpful. Obviously, there are situations where there's a child that's been born as a result of certain things, and I've had many couples be able to work through that, and obviously they're supporting a child at that point. So that would be something between you and your wife. How will I ever be able to find, number four, how will I ever be able to find the person of me, whoever I was, when things were good, knowing no matter how hard I try or what choices I will make, the people I've always loved and those I came to love will be hurt for a lifetime. Is the only peace to come with death. I'm not talking about suicide. Just the normal finish of the journey of life. Will I ever be able to accept or be okay with me to move beyond all of these emotions and intense guilt for complicating, destroying the safety and safe place in our head and in our hearts that come with love and hope in so many lives? What is the rest of my journey? The answer to that is not only will you find the person you were, you're going to discover far more of who you are. And not only if you, I think, work program, do you come out of this thing as good as you were, I think you come out far better because you end up with more self-respect. And peace comes much sooner than you can possibly imagine. Yes, we hurt other people. At the same time, what I experienced as a result of hurting other people was I received more cotton-picking love from others. I mean, I was never loved unconditionally as long as I was only conditionally letting other people know who I was. And when I wounded them, many of them, they just loved me anyway. Now, there was a season of grieving where they had to move through the pain. That season, you know, that is not the rest of a lifetime. That season, like we talk about, max is 18 to 24 months. But usually by the end of a year, 90% of the pain, other than the fact that we have our year triggers that kind of kick things back up, 90 to 95% of the pain seems to have subsided for people by that time. When I was eating lunch with Ann Brett at the Smart Marriages Conference, it was really funny because we were talking about Brian, Ann's husband. We were joking about some of his infidelity issues. And, you know, some of the other people at the table were just kind of taken aback. And Steph and I were kind of joking a little bit. And they said, how can you joke? And I said, well, usually by 5 years, people are able to joke. I mean, it's not that it's funny in a sense, but it doesn't carry the pain anymore. And even loved ones talk about it, and it's not a painful piece. So I can promise you that people definitely move beyond it. And the last paragraph here, I know you mostly talk on or with those who have been the affected partner. I asked you might give a few minutes to the emotional roller coaster of me. And absolutely. And the only reason I talk about the affected partner, since I was actually the unfaithful one, is because so far the affected partners have done most of the writing or question asking. But I love the fact that you're asking questions because I think it's incredibly relevant. The roller coaster that the unfaithful mate goes through is an incredible shame cycle. Now, the shame cycle typically is not as intense for the hurt spouse. Now, it can be if they're accepting a lot of responsibility for what occurred. But, you know, usually the person that begins to experience the shame is the one who was unfaithful. And so anytime they have a reminder and someone's upset with them as a result of what happened, then it sends them spiraling down into that shame cycle. And the message of shame is that I am bad. There's something wrong with me. I'm damaged freight. You know, I'm this, I'm that. And so then there's a – that's why the unfaithful mate – is almost, it gets very defensive, because behind defensiveness will always be shame. And whenever we start feeling bad about ourselves, we immediately want to begin to defend and explain why we weren't or why somebody else is. We have to come up with an explanation to keep from drowning in the pain. That's actually one of the dynamics that's difficult for couples, period, because if the hurt spouse begins to speak about their discomfort and or their pain or reminders and all of that, then what it does is it triggers the shame. Unfaithful spouse, if they've been incapable of accepting grace and kind of extending that forgiveness to themselves. So it gets to be really complicated. So, but any reminders or anybody being upset with them sets off the roller coaster. Then, you know, if they are doing well and it seems like everybody's happy with them, then they're elated, and then the next time people are disappointed with them, they go down. So they kind of ride the roller coaster. If they're not doing recovery right, they'll ride everybody's ups and downs just in almost a perfect parallel. So the real trick is, I always call it the third option. It's not to evaluate yourself by how others see you, but it's really beginning to commit to become the person that you think you were supposed to be, who God wanted you to be, and letting that be the guiding criteria, not what other people think. And part of recovery, I think, is very much admitting what we really are, and accepting it, being okay with it, integrating kind of our own dark side, and receiving grace. And at the same time, as they say in 12 Step, you know, praying only for the knowledge of His will in my life and the power to carry that out, that's my goal. How do I just stay my path and my course while everybody else is kind of, you know, falling around me? So I hope that explains why the roller coaster and how, and that is very intense, that shame cycle. If you don't get out of that, it's very intense, and if you don't break it, it almost guarantees relapse. Next question. Janet, those are great questions. This is Samuel. Wow, Janet, those are great questions. I'm an unfaithful too, and if you need to talk to someone who has dealt with those issues and still does at times, please know that I'm here for you. I'm a mentor on the site and go by the name Samuel. You can find me on the general forums and prayer forums. I'd love a chance to chat with you. You need, if you need some help in accessible, in it, if you need some help that is accessible easily, let me know. The very fact that you're asking these questions, though, is hope for you and your loved ones. Good comment, Samuel. Way to go.
Hey, I was just trying to help. I wasn't trying to take over. I just thought, hey, if she doesn't post anywhere else, I'll post this. And, hey, I get to be on the call. Now I'm recorded. Okay, I'm done. Thanks.
Thank you, Samuel. It's always fun, man. I mean, those are great questions. So obviously, if anybody else is on here that's with those of us who've been unfaithful, I just want you to know that, you know, whoever wrote those questions just did an absolutely bang-up job, and that's a great standard, guys. All of you are women. If you can write questions like that, it's great. Hey, Charles. Oh, we got another unfaithful one. That's a good day. I've been attending a 12-step recovery program, and I just started a step study post-EMS. I'm excited about the journey ahead, but I'm still struggling with sexual desire. In the past, I would use porn to self-gratify. Eventually, that would lead me to acting out with other partners. I'm not using porn anymore, and my sex life with my wife is pretty good. I have no desire to go anywhere close to that road I used to be on, but on some days, I have some pretty strong urges. I don't like the pressure, and if I'm not careful, I use my wife to relieve it. When that happens, sex is all about me and not exactly what God intended. So, is masturbation totally off limits to relieve the pressure? Do you have other tips to handle that pressure? Curious? Thanks. Wow. Now, that's a real question right there. Okay, next question. That was a joke. See, it was just nobody's laughing. That was funny.
I'm laughing.
Okay. Charles, are you on the line? Would you admit it if you're on the line? I bet some wife wrote this. Is the person who wrote this on the line?
Rick, I don't think they are. They would show up probably as a Texas person, I think, because that's Charles, Charles and Dana that were at EMS.
Okay.
So right. I think that they're probably not on.
Okie dokie.
But look at your Skype. I sent you another question. We missed a question apparently a couple of weeks ago, and the author of that question is online and would really like it answered. So if we fit that in.
Let me answer Charles's question, and
yes.
Then I'll go back to this question.
Okay, great. Thanks.
Actually, depending on how bad the urges are, a lot of times one of the things that I recommend to help with some of the urges is medication, believe it or not. That's one possibility. Sometimes the SSRIs work pretty good in terms of helping reduce urges. So that's if the addiction has been pretty strong or the whole sexual acting out, that'll help. The second one that can work pretty good, a lot of times I recommend a sexual fast of like 90 days. And I know that sounds paradoxical to sit there and say, okay, we'll stop having sex. But frequently when you stop having sex, then and you wait 90 days to have any sort of release, it kind of resets the clock and gets a little bit more back to normal. But it also lets you begin to understand what you're using sex for in terms of what emotions, what feelings, how you were numbing out. And so frequently, that is a great approach to go ahead and try the 90 days with no sex. I'm sure that excited everybody to hear that. In terms of masturbation, to me, I'm just going to share my opinion. This is not God. This is just my opinion. My issue with masturbation typically, and my concern about masturbation is more about the fantasy and the unhealthy ways or the unhealthy attitudes that are frequently generated through masturbation. So, you know, if I've got somebody, I've got two suggestions of somebody, if it's okay with both husband and wife, and I do think it needs to be kind of something that both agree is okay. And but if you are, there's two solutions to masturbation. One would be what I call fantasy-less masturbation. And in a fantasy-less masturbation, literally it's just that. It's sensate focus. You don't focus on, you don't use any fantasy. You just focus on the sensation and let that take you to an orgasm. Interestingly enough, Charles, in that situation, a large number of women, that's exactly how they masturbate. They don't use fantasy as much. They're not as visual. So it is possible. So that's one possibility if it's okay with your wife. The second one is what I call healthy sexual fantasy. And in a healthy sexual fantasy, it's instead of reinforcing something negative, you begin to reinforce or create something positive. And so if I've got somebody doing healthy sexual fantasy, it always starts off that fantasy is five components, and I'll have them write the fantasy even just to begin to think it through. The first one is meaningful conversation that's just about the other person and interest in the other person. The second is clear initiation, very clear. It's not kind of just a subtle hint. The ability to speak desire for the other person. The third one is meaningful foreplay. The fourth one is intercourse, and the woman gets to decide when that begins, and no simultaneous orgasms. And then the fifth one, the fifth component is meaningful afterplay, where you continue to speak and visit and enjoy and hold and cuddle and connect after the sexual act. If somebody wants to create that sort of sexual fantasy and masturbate to that with their wife, or, you know, where it's about their wife, then if you're reinforcing, I guess, healthy pieces of that and kind of rewiring your brain about what you find arousing, that would be my other piece where I would say masturbation can be helpful. Anybody have any questions on that? Okay, so I shouldn't be asking if people have questions on that because it's going to get complicated. Okay. Hi, Rick. I was hoping you could explain and give some understanding as to how, after the discovery of your spouse's affair or affairs, it can change how you feel even towards your child. We did answer this one last time. Aaron, are you there? Aaron. Well, she didn't.
I'm here. I couldn't get the mouse to work. Sorry about that.
We did?
She couldn't find it on the audio. Okay. We'll go back and look for it on the audio then.
It looked like, because I did. I talked about how what it does in terms of the connection with our need for attachment and the attachment distress, and when the attachment distress is disturbed or, you know, we're really hurt, then it impacts our ability to connect with children. So, yeah, I covered that at length in that last call.
Okay. Well, Kathy and I will go look for it then. Sorry.
You and Kathy can find that one, 'cause I know it's there.
She said nobody else could find it either. I wonder if we uploaded the wrong file, maybe.
Yeah.
If we can't find it, can we answer it next week?
Yes.
Okay.
But I did such a good job the first time.
Deal.
I couldn't find it.
I hope so, too. I wonder, was it possibly after the recording ended?
Nope.
No?
No,
okay.
I heard it on the recording.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I'll keep looking then. Sorry about that. Go back to this week's question.
Okay. In rewriting our history during Harboring Hope, my husband told me that he had not loved me before we had gotten married and did not love me until he had a spiritual awakening during some couple's work after a month after discovery, about 2+ years ago. We've been married 35 years, so this was a major blow for me. He keeps saying, "I didn't love you then, but I love you now." We are recovering addicts with 20 years of recovery, and I know the importance of now, but I'm still overwhelmed by the amount of time and lack of feeling for me. He has truly acted these 2 years as if he does love me, but I thought he had before, too. Harboring Hope recommends going back to when a couple were first together and remember good things. But, frankly, someone telling me that he didn't love me for 35 years is not too heartwarming. My husband has realized he's a sex addict, and we've been doing a lot of reading about sexual anorexia, the description which seems to fit our situation to a T. Is there any hope for our situation when there's really no positive past to draw on? He said that what had been important to him was how much I loved him, and that he could do whatever he wanted, and that I would still love him, and he could withhold himself from me. Help. Well,
that's me.
Hello, Miss Wendy.
Hello.
My first thought on that is, you're right when you say we're recovering addicts with 20 years each in recovery, and I know the importance of now, but I'm overwhelmed by the amount of time and the lack of feeling for me. To me, what's important is if someone loves you now or they've got the feelings, there is no need to go back to recreate, I think to recreate, Wendy, the love. I mean, he's got that. Now, you may not have it, but he's probably got it.
Mm-hmm.
So that may be a bigger issue as to whether or not you've got it, but he's got it. And with that being the case...
Well, let me say this. I think I do love him, but on many levels, I'm afraid to love him because I think part of it is I don't trust it because I was so sure about him before.
Right.
Yes.
Well, and you know.
Hey, Rick.
Yes.
This is Jim. A recovering addict for 20 years, what kind of addict?
Drug addiction.
Okay. And the affairs for how long? Or the issue
wasn't
with
an affair,
the,
it was sexual addiction.
Okay.
Yeah. And
okay.
Multiple emotional affairs.
Okay. Okay.
And so, you know, the best way that I tell couples to know whether or not it's real or not. How do you know that they're really there or not? I really do believe in recovery when honesty begins to happen, Wendy, that there is a much greater level of connection, a much deeper level of connection. And to me, it's that connection, that intimacy we begin to experience, kind of a depth that we've never had before, that is the marker or the barometer that you use to begin to measure kind of what the new things. It's almost like you need something that feels different than what was before. You may have been happy before, or you may have been content before, but hopefully you're able to feel more connected just because he's being more transparent than he was before. And if that's the case, then, you know, what you want to do is hold on to that. I don't know do you sense that there's a deeper connection with him now than there was before?
I guess part of my thing is there have been multiple disclosures over this time
right.
period. And the last one about sexual addiction was like 3 months ago. So each time one of these happens, it kind of throws me for a loop for a while, you know, and then I'm taking them better as time goes on. But so I guess there's, you know, he's more open. Part of the thing is I think he tells me as soon as he has an awareness.
Right.
I don't think it's that he's specifically hiding anything anymore. I think each of us is coming to understandings, you know, the more we know, the more we understand, and then, you know, move forward, you know, just like in any kind of recovery. And, you know, and I want to trust it, and I want to feel closer. But, you know, I feel like in our relationship, I laid it all on the line to start out with, you know. And especially after we got into recovery, I had this spiritual practice that I would do, you know, when somebody, you know, instead of getting angry with somebody, if something happened, I was upset with him, I would try to get centered and I would do something with love for him, you know. And in doing that, it transformed the anger for me into love, you know. So I just, the more I did, the more loving I felt toward him. And so, I mean, I was doing this for years and years and years. And, I mean, granted, I wasn't doing it to make him love me or anything. I was doing it as a spiritual practice, and I was doing it for me. But, you know, it was not received by him in a loving way. It just made him more resentful and angry. And I didn't realize that. So it's like anything that I had used before for healing or getting better, it feels like it doesn't have validity anymore. And it's just like all my markers are gone, and all my, you know, anything that I operated by. So it's like, you know, he's being extremely open with me. And before, I've been totally open with him,
right.
But now I'm kind of, you know, I'm like, ooh. And one of the things we talked about was that in our relationship that he had never had to pursue me.
Right.
And that, you know, he says, I think that was probably a very bad thing. You know, I think you should, you know, now, you know, he said, I liked it at the time. And so now I've got it in my head, okay, you know, as soon as I act like I want him again, he's going to do an about face and we're going to be back to where we were before.
Yeah, you know, ultimately you're talking about a distancer pursuer relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And that is something, I mean, I understand your fear and trust after 35 years and feeling like 35 years of history has been a lie. I mean, that's pretty disorienting, to be honest. But I would say you need probably a good professional marriage therapist who can...
Yes, well, we tried that, and it had many of the classic worst things that you've ever been told.
Well, that, yeah.
Characteristic to it, yeah.
You, certainly a marriage counselor who understands this. You don't get those...
We're going to be doing the 911 thing together.
Good. Well, and I think some of that will be addressed there. And certainly the aftercare program for 911 totally addresses this. And because there's at least 6 months of aftercare after 911 that talks a lot about pursuit and avoidance patterns. And how do you break those patterns?
Yes, I just finished the Harboring Hope thing, and now we're going to do the 911 together.
Yes, and so that you'll find that we, especially in the aftercare program, we hit the distancer pursuer hard. So you'll be able to get, I think, what you need to address that.
Okay.
But don't work with a counselor that doesn't know how to work with that, because you will get the worst. You'll win the contest on...
Oh, I know,
the worst.
I know. I think that set us back a lot.
Oh, I hate that. I'm so sorry.
Yeah.
Okay, we've got just a minute. Let me try to get this last question in. You know, Kathy Ann got us here because she posted it during the call, but that's okay. Hey, Rick, I'm reading a post by another member. Realize that our current situation, I may lose my battery here if I do so much. For that, are you still, everybody still there?
Yes.
Hello? Okay, good. If I die, I die. I've also have an ongoing feeling that my husband is also doing, as the other member posted, just enough to keep me on hanging on to hope. My husband has a problem facing his feelings. Whenever something happens that makes him I don't know. Something has to happen soon. I'm so tired. I just don't think I can continue to fight it anymore. Which would be fine for him. He would love to pretend like everything is fine. As long as he's getting what he needs, he sits there and doesn't notice that his wife is miserable. My husband did do the exercise the counselor gave him once for 30 minutes when he quit because he started becoming upset. And we can't have him being upset. It makes him too uncomfortable. I didn't say anything to him because I wanted to give him credit for what he was doing. It's just irritating to watch him do just enough to keep me hanging on to hope. My husband has a problem facing his feelings. Whenever something happens that makes him feel uncomfortable, he shoves it away, doesn't process it with the affair. He feels bad, feels guilty, doesn't like to think about it, shoves it away, leaves me feeling like I'm swinging in the wind by myself. He's not as bad as some. He doesn't tell me to get over it or anything, but he's kind of like an empty shell just sitting there waiting for me to get over it. He tries to soothe me, but he feels empty, hollow, like he's going to go through the motions, not really any meaning in it. And when I ask questions about the affair, I get a lot of I thinks, maybes, it could be best because. He doesn't really want to stop and examine and come up with true answers because it makes him uncomfortable. Now my question is this: as betrayed wives, what can we do at this point? As for me, my husband did finally agree to do something and to doing the mentor program, but so far the difficulties have been in the way he's not actually been able to contact with the mentor yet. I'm really hoping and praying that he will really have an aha moment and turn the corner soon. Pretend normal is so empty. On the surface, one might think that things are just okay, but on a deeper level, I still don't feel connected the way I know I need to be. He truly thinks he's doing so much, but to me, it just feels like he stopped short of going anywhere with this, and it makes him feel too uncomfortable, even if it's what I truly need him to do so I can feel close enough to him again and heal emotionally. Never mind how uncomfortable I feel because things stay so shallow all the time. What do we do? By the way, I cannot join the call. I'll have to listen later. Quickly, in 2 minutes, something like, again, if you've never done EMS, the 911 course would be good for someone like this. But in the long run, he needs to do some individual work and learn how to modulate his anxiety. And there are some very specific exercises that help guys who are emotionally constipated ultimately to be able to deal with their anxiety and to face things and learn to get their heart reconnected. This guy sounds like a double E, an electrical engineer. That's a very common problem. Working with other men and in a 12-step recovery group oftentimes helps because it's almost modeled for them how to begin to deal with the emotions. But I do think it's not unrealistic to hope, to pray, to push for something more and something better. And with that, I do need to get off the call for today. Look forward to next Thursday, guys. Great questions today. Thank you very much, and I hope everybody has a good week. I'll talk to you later. Okay, bye-bye, guys.
Thanks, sir.
Bye.